Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. Today's special guest is Maggie Cohn. She's the showrunner of The Staircase, now on HBO Max. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars.
Hello, Ms. Cohn. Thank you so much for coming to the Traversing the Stars podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's totally my pleasure. I had the pleasure of watching The Staircase, fantastic show on HBO Max. Thank you so much for making it.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Enjoy not only the quality of the acting and the writing, but it's definitely something that gets your mind, you know, thinking on the guilt, the innocence. It has a lot of nuance to it as well. It's fantastically done.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time investigating the true crime genre, and we really wanted to do something different. And so we found that most shows are moving towards a single truth and, you know, right, wrong, like a very firm sense of justice. And what we wanted to do with our show was explore the idea that there is no single truth, and that justice is often defined by what you bring to the story as opposed to what the story is bringing to you.
I mean, it's a fascinating case. I will admit I was not familiar with the case prior to The Staircase, but I do know that the gentleman, Michael Peterson, that we'll be talking about, hopefully this is not a spoiler, but I mean, it's history, so hopefully it's not a spoiler. But I know Michael Peterson was initially found guilty, later acquitted and put on a different charge. Is it difficult to then walk that line where you're neither making it definitely condemning him as saying 100% guilty, nor are you trying to argue the other side? You try to keep it maybe to the fact. Is that a difficult line to walk?
It is difficult, but I think it's as difficult as walking the line of certainty, which in this case, there was a lot of ambiguity. A lot of the evidence pointed in a multitude of directions. And while I think, you know, while we were in the writer's room, everyone certainly had an opinion on what happened that night. Those opinions changed. And some didn't. And I think what we were trying to do initially and try to maintain it is that, again, it wasn't avoiding bias or pretending it didn't exist. It was accounting for it. So I think it was difficult only in the sense that it was somewhat of a new approach to writing for most of us. And it certainly was for me to kind of give that as like an edict for the room. That was novel. But I think that in the difficulty that we experienced, the difficulty we experienced was made up for in the sense that we were doing something that to us felt fresh and exciting in exploring true crime in this kind of from this new angle.
Does truth and entertainment butt heads in the creating something like this, where on the one hand, obviously you want to stick to what you know of the facts, what's thought to have happened. But of course, on the other hand, is you're doing a TV show, entertainment become, you know, does have its place as well. How do you balance those two elements, entertainment and truth?
Well, I think they absolutely butt heads. And one of the themes of our show is not only kind of the investigation of what truth is, but the investigation of storytelling and its relationship to truth. And so throughout the series, we use different devices to show how stories are told. We have stories that are told in a courtroom. We have a documentary team that we see constructing a story, a narrative in front of our eyes. And we hope that in seeing that, those performances and those visual cues, that it does instill in the viewer a sense of critical thinking about the narrative that we're presenting to them.
Now, when you're making any kind of entertainment, any kind of show, one thing you have to keep in mind is audience.
Yep.
Now, when you're creating this, is your audience, or at least the first and foremost, the audience of those who may not be familiar with the case, or those familiar with the case looking for it being dramatized in a show?
I think we were trying to do, you know, two birds with one stone in the sense. We definitely wanted to create a show that you could go into and watch without having any familiarity with the case or the event. We also wanted to, you know, address the fact that many of the viewers coming to the show would have knowledge that they're bringing with them. And so it's fairly easy to do both of those things at once. I think a lot of, you know, most of my experience is writing, you know, bringing to life nonfiction. And so I often find that it's absorbing a bunch of research and facts at the beginning, letting that sit in, and then bringing it to life. And to an extent, it's always inspired by, which we emphasize with our show. It's not based on a true story, it's inspired by one. And so it's kind of, I think it's almost, it sounds more complicated than it is, ultimately. I want to seem smart, but I think it's just, you know, having written straight fiction, that presents its own set of issues. So it's kind of whichever one you want to dive into.
Well, I'm sure it sounds less complicated to someone as yourself who's talented and knows how to do it. Someone like me would be probably confused and befuddled about how to balance these two things at once. Well, I mean, you do have a degree from Vassar, mm-hmm. political science and film.
Yep.
So is there a line between your career in political science and your education and doing basically true crime, and how you either create or balance it, or at least translate it to your audience?
Yeah, I mean, I think having studied film theory and also political theory, these things are, they're not as different as one may think, especially when you're talking about more general ideas about perspective, about who holds the gaze and who's creating the perspective. And so I often bring that into both. And when I went to Vassar, it was often commented on that it was two interesting things to major in. And I often said that, you know, film and they helped me explore each other, one another. And so it was, again, it was a little bit easier to do it both because they spoke to me. I do believe that media does have a chance to shape the world. And I do think that, you know, obviously politics is shaping the world every day. So I think the commentary that they have on one another is pretty, it's a pretty strong connection.
Would you say there's a performative nature to both politics and entertainment then?
Yes.
Because I was thinking, you know, both of those, I mean, there is, and like my mind, what I was thinking about, there's two aspects that seem to be the same. One, both are actors on some level, and two, both have a look into human nature. Politics is trying to understand what people want, and I guess entertainment is trying to figure out as well what people need and want as well for entertainment. And I was wondering, from your perspective, what does that say to you that you are good at both? Like, do you feel you have insights into thought, psychology in that sense, and why that makes you good at what you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think again, it kind of goes back to the way that these two subjects speak to one another and how political theory and film theory aren't that different. It depends. I think people enter politics and they enter entertainment with different objectives. The objectives can be very similar when you enter politics and entertainment, but they can, what your objective is, it can be, not everyone enters for the same reason. Some people enter politics and entertainment because they want to, save the world. They want to shape the world. They want to meld it to fit their needs. They want to make it more suitable for other people's needs. I mean, these are vast generalizations, but I think there is, you know, public policy and legislation and film, they comment on one another and they're influenced by one another. You know, the filmmaker, I'm not putting responsibility on filmmakers, and I think there's probably more film responsibility to put on politicians simply because of the, you know, implicit contract that you have with the public and your constituents.
No, I agree with you completely. When you decided to, I mean, a lot of your work focuses on ideas of true crime. What do you think is the draw for an audience in true crime? Is it the mystery? Is it a voyeurism? What is the true crime lure to an audience?
I think the lure to an audience, or in my experience of reading kind of about the psychology behind it, is that viewers, it's not voyeurism. I actually think humanity is a little bit better than wanting to stare at train wrecks all day. I think it's about wanting to be able to have some form of control over the entropy that is life, meaning we want the ability to either foresee or prevent tragedy from happening to us, whether it's something that is completely unpredictable or whether it's something that slowly we could have seen coming. And so I think with true crime, the true crime genre, people are looking for clues. They're looking for little things that have happened in real life to other people and trying to say, well, how do I prevent it from happening to me or somebody that I love? It's a very natural inclination. And I don't think it's a lesson or, you know, an exercise in futility, but it is a bit of a primal instinct, I think, that is worth investigating. Why are we looking for answers when ultimately we'll never have all of them?
Right. Well, like, one cool thing about watching like The Staircase is that even though I know what happened, I find myself watching going, it's not going to this time. You know, like somehow you think to yourself in the show, like this time it the character, you know, won't die, there won't be this issue, but once again, obviously we know.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's really observant, and that's what we're trying to play with is this, you know, I referenced it fairly early on in the project where I'm like, we have to understand that this is the Titanic. We know what happens.
Right.
And so a lot of our show, which does set it apart, I think, is that it's about filling out a character that we hadn't seen in the documentary, and the character that we don't often see fully realized in many true crime, which is, you know, the quote unquote victim, which in this case was Kathleen Peterson. And so we get to see this really complicated and vibrant and, you know, beautiful, full of life woman. And we hopefully like more fully realize her, which is a better way of understanding what happened. And then it's not just about, again, I'm a bit contradicting myself, but it's not just about making her a victim, but understanding like what the absence, what Kathleen's absence was for this family moving forward. And, you know, tragedy can beget tragedy. And I think ultimately when you do something like this, you are trying to prevent that sort of chain of events from occurring. And so, with, you know, and fully realizing Kathleen, we hope we're telling a part of the story that hasn't been told before and deserves to be seen and understood.
Well, how you present the relationship is absolutely fascinating. I mean, obviously, for those who may not be familiar with the case itself, when you're watching the show, the question obviously is whether or not Michael Peterson is the murderer or not, or I mean, was it accidental fall or the murderer? And what you see in the early episodes, this show very interestingly weaves in and out of that question, because at some point they seem, you know, like a happy couple. There's the party, things seem like they're going well, they're a happy couple. And other times it's fraught with animosity. There's seems like hostility there. And I think the way you weave in and out of it is not only on the one hand, fascinating, but in many ways also as natural of a relationship as you can think of, because once again, in many movies are either, you know, the couple's either at odds throughout the movie or the show, or they're the happy couple and that's their story. Very rarely do you see a couple that in a relationship that's that active.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think most people in relationships to some degree can relate to the ebb and flow of love and of ease with one another. We wanted to create a relationship that felt real. And we wanted to create a relationship that felt like it could sustain the three outcomes, or led to three outcomes that we present within the series. But I think that is, again, going back to the idea of why people watch true crime, it's not because most of these scenarios feel like a complete anomaly. It's because these scenarios feel like they might be able to happen to you. And so I think that, you know, in the case of the Petersons, it was, I think, some of the spectacle, if you will, was the fact that when you pull back the curtain, this seemingly perfect, presentable family wasn't everything that they, you know, pretended to be. And so I think a lot of, I mean, that's relatable. I mean, I think most people tend to be, try to put their best foot forward in a public way. So yeah, we really wanted to give that portrayal of the Petersons, because not only did it seem accurate to what was occurring at the time, but it's relatable. And I think the viewers, it adds to the story. It connects them more.
Now for listeners who might not be familiar with the case, it takes place in the events occur in 2001, roughly around the time, soon after 9/11, looks like most of that has occurred.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. One of the things I found that was kind of interesting, I kind of maybe want you to comment on it, is how is handled the fact that Michael Peterson is revealed to be potentially bisexual, maybe gay, but bisexual. Do you think the events would have been different if it happened more current, you know, in modern time, instead of 2001, and how the family handles it, how the secret is handled by Michael Peterson at that moment?
I think, I think, you know, whenever you're bringing in political issues into a case, you are dealing with the societal perception of somebody. And in 2001, bisexuality was definitely received differently than it would be in contemporary times. That's not to say that prejudice still doesn't exist, and that his bisexuality would have been used as the discovery of it would have been probably still used as a motive for why a horrible event could occur. I also think this was a time when DNA testing wasn't happening, which we'll see in future episodes, we'll see what the investigative methods, how they do come into question. So ultimately it does go back to what I was saying before, which is this is a show as much about storytelling, which is what you do with evidence, how no matter how you receive it, these little pieces, it creates a story. And for the prosecution, the story was very much centered around infidelity. And in this case, the form of infidelity was a man sleeping with another man. And they, for the most part, did use that as a bit of a sensational piece of information that would have upset someone like Kathleen Peterson, who was presenting as, you know, this perfect housewife / businesswoman.
Now, obviously, we know about the documentary by, I'm going to probably get the name wrong, Jean Xavier de Lestrade.
Jean
Lestrade. I knew I was going to miss, I'll get it wrong.
At some point, you're just like,
yes, exactly. Yeah. So, thank you. I appreciate that. So, when you're, as the showrunner, you're conceiving the story and you're helping put the pieces together, you know, you have the documentary that people will have seen. I think it was even on Netflix next to it. What are you trying to show in your series that might not have been present in the documentary? What parts of the documentary did you want to make sure you hit upon? And also, was there your own research done, or did the was the documentary part of a backbone of some of the research done for the show?
Yeah, I mean, the documentary, so I think there's a lot of questions to unpack there, which is we did a lot of research outside of the documentary. You know, we optioned Written Blood by Diane Fanning, which is a slightly more prosecution oriented supported piece of media or, you know, literature. And you know, our theory, our research ranged from everything from, you know, primary blood spatter sources, you know, talking to experts, and just not to try and figure it out, but to try and figure out how their minds work. Mm. It's more character oriented research as opposed to research into trying to solve something. Mm. And then to Reddit forums, you know, like, because again, we're not trying to recreate the truth. We're trying to have a better understanding of the zeitgeist that already surrounded this event, and then comment on that with our show. So the research ran, it was, you know, quite diverse. That being said, so the documentary was part of the research, but it was part of the research in the sense that we need to understand how they were making the documentary, so then we could show how the documentary was made in our shows. They are characters. And I think what's interesting for a viewer that, you know, didn't study film in college is that this idea that documentaries are just as much of a construction of a narrative as a feature film or a TV series. And we quite literally show a documentary being constructed. And then we also juxtapose that against a court case. And so it really is hoping to give the viewers the tools to be as critical of the fact of what we're presenting to them. Not necessarily critical and this is bad, but critical in the way that, like, oh, if they can be telling a story and I'm seeing the story being constructed on screen, it makes sense to then extrapolate that I am also being told a story and that there's possibilities that they're leaving, there being me and the other writers, are leaving out pieces of information or couldn't put pieces of information in, and that this isn't, that this is life, that we all get pieces of information and we'll never fully understand anything. And actually, again, that's what we're trying to move people towards, is comfort with that, comfort with entropy, with the fact that we can't control everything.
Well, I mean, one thing that you've done in The Staircase, I mean, it's cast wonderfully. I mean, Colin Firth, Sophie Turner, Parker Posey, Toni Collette. I mean, it's a hell of, I mean, the cast... It's sort of like an Oscar wish list of who to put in this movie.
Yeah.
And part of me was wondering, and once again, Colin Firth is a wonderful actor and he's likable. Is there ever a danger putting an actor so likable in a role like Michael Peterson, where you know the audience automatically wants to be like, Colin, you know, wants to like just gravitate towards him and be like, I'm on his side because, you know, he's Colin Firth. You know, is it hard to have an actor that likable in a part that's that questionable?
I think that those are the most exciting casting choices. It is always fun to work with the public perception of somebody and subvert it. And I think, of course, there's always a danger in doing that. But when you have someone as talented as Colin, and the character again has a lot of facets to Michael Pearson, has many facets to him, it doesn't feel like you're taking a huge risk. What it feels like is, I can't wait to see what happens. And so, I think in casting, that's kind of my approach, is it's talent over anything. And then also, how do people already see this person and character? Because that is the backstory that they're bringing to our story. Just as every viewer is going to bring their backstory to our story. It is a continuous idea, and it is a bit of a holistic approach to the construction of the entire series. What are people already bringing with them? But in turn, I mean, the cast, we got very, very lucky that the cast was interested in this subject. Everyone was very intelligent and thoughtful and respectful and really created this environment that I think allowed people to feel safe to explore such a, you know, a complicated and, you know, tragic event.
How confident did it make you in the project when you realized just how much talent wanted to be a part of it? Like you said, the cast is phenomenal.
I mean, it's always encouraging. it's encouraging, but also I think in a sense that it also means that if something isn't as successful as you want it to be, obviously it wasn't the talent in acting that was the problem.
You know, it's on you then at that point. It
get a little higher for the writer and the director, I guess. But you don't hope for the opposite. We got very lucky with our cast.
Is the pressure then on you to, I mean, once again, when you had that many actors, like I said, Sophie Turner, I mean, these are some big names who everyone knows and not only as quality actors, but, you know, have been major players in their own other series to make sure that they each have enough to do to make it worth their time to do it.
I think because of the characters that they were playing, they understood the nature of the show would be a more family focus, a family united focus show. And then naturally as people age, they would diverge. And since they diverge, there's less family scenes. I don't want to speak for the actors, but I think probably what's most interesting isn't the amount of screen time, but what you're doing with the time that you're on screen. And so if you are, you know, you could be on for 60 minutes, but if you're not doing anything interesting or challenging to you, it's not as compelling. But if you have a couple, you know, scenes that are really, it's taking you to a place that you haven't explored or been to before, well, then perhaps the project is a little more worthwhile than something that you've already experienced. But, you know, again, I don't want to speak for our talented actors who have strong voices for themselves.
Well, like I said, they're amazing. And the chemistry among the characters is amazing. I mean, once again, Toni Collette and Colin Firth.
Yeah.
It doesn't take long to feel like they're an old married couple together. I mean, after like maybe 20 minutes, you're like, you just kind of fall into the character. They become Michael Peterson. They become Kathleen Peterson. And you forget that these are actors and they haven't been in this relationship for how many years, you know, you fall into it very quickly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, they're doing the things that we all do, you know, they make dinner, you know, they talk about the kids, they talk about money problems, you know, this is not stuff that's out of the ordinary. And I think there's a curiosity in the mundane. I remember there's a documentary called Night Mail, and I'm forgetting who made it, but it's an old one. And essentially, but it's about, and you can make anything interesting, even a train that delivers mail at night. So, and that's kind of like the idea. It's, you know, and I think leaning into those moments allows you to feel like, yeah, this is a married couple. This is an ordinary family where something extraordinary happened one night, and why is kind of the question, really.
Yeah, I mean, episode two has, without giving any spoilers, I don't think this is really a big spoiler, has one of the, in my opinion, one of the most intense moments, a couple of most intense moments that I've seen. Not only do they, it's when they reenact what probably happened.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, Michael Peterson, played by Colin Firth, has to sit and kind of be there while they're reenacting it a little bit.
Right.
And then they play that recorder where it's, you know, the cry for help recorder, and it keeps repeating, help me, help me, help me.
Right.
And obviously he has to hear it and then obviously go outside to see if they still can. Can you talk me through, I mean, that's such an emotional scene, how that was handled, and I mean, that did we know for a fact that definitely is what they did during it? And kind of talk me through a little bit how Colin Farrell's, how you kind of worked with him and how his mindset during that moment. Because it's also potentially really revealing as well, guilt to innocence based on how he responds to it.
Correct. And so that scene, that sequence is in 102 or in our second episode is intercutting with a different timeline. So it's the present timeline intercutting with the past timeline. And we want to suggest is that, you know, while Michael is looking at the defense team in the staircase, coming up, we see the story, their story of what happened that night evolving, because what we've learned is, you know, Michael says he was asleep by the pool when all of this happened. And all he knows is kind of what the scene that we see at the beginning of the pilot. Kathleen was at the bottom of the stairs. She was fairly unresponsive, and then she passed away. And so what the defense team is doing is filling in that blank using the evidence at hand. And so I think ultimately the way that you play it is that, you know, it's not about guilt or innocence, but about the fact that something happened in that staircase, regardless of what it was, that wasn't supposed to happen. And that is, it's different varieties of emotion, but that is a core emotion, which is something bad happened. Either way you look at it, and what is your emotional reaction to that? And then of course, because of the way it was shot, you have to kind of interweave it and have him moving into from the defense team into the past timeline, which is him at a campaign fundraiser where everything's going great. Kathleen's alive. It's a successful fundraiser. Life is good. And so it was really about the juxtaposition of those emotions that I think kind of highlights one another. And in terms of what's real, I mean, there were a multitude of defense team experts, as there are in most cases where you're paying for your defense. And the recorder of the woman saying, help me, was something that you do see in the actual documentary. And so we did, that was one of the moments that we decided to loosely reenact within our narrative.
So for, once again, for our listeners, where can they find The Staircase? How many episodes is it? And is there going to be multiple seasons, or is it one full season?
You can find The Staircase on HBO Max, and the first three episodes are available, and then one will be, or episodes will be released weekly every Thursday night. So the fourth episode will air on the 12th. Yes, I can do math. Yeah, 12th. And, you know, as for another season, I guess that remains to be seen, but there's only one staircase. That's all I can say.
So what is next for you?
Oh, what is next for me? Oh, well, you know, there's always something cooking. Right now what's next for me is maybe a trip to Mexico.
Nice vacation.
Yeah, exactly. Escape. That's what it is. That's what's next for me.
Well, Ms. Cohen, it was my pleasure to speak with you. I want our listeners to check out The Staircase on HBO Max. And thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate it.
It's totally my pleasure.
Me too.
Have a fantastic night.